I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Will now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back, nothing is required of you, except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright, hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
We are anonymous. We are legion. We do not forgive. We do not forget. Expect us.
Barrett Brown. I'm the director of Project PM and a former operative with Anonymous.
Rick's like super passionate about this argument.
A Dallas activist and writer whose criminal case attracted national attention was sentenced to prison today. Barrett Brown received 5 years in prison for his role for the hacking group Anonymous.
Brown's attorneys, who argued Brown operating as a journalist, merely posted a link which happened to contain stolen data, and he shouldn't be punished for it.
Breaking news, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange arrested in London. After 7 years of asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy, the Ecuadorian government released Assange to British authorities, and he could now face charges in the U.S.
The official charge from U.S. authorities in an indictment unsealed this morning that he conspired with Chelsea Manning to hack computers and publish classified documents and data related to the U.S. war effort in Iraq and Afghanistan. Chelsea Manning went to jail for those charges until she was eventually pardoned by President Obama. Now it's Julian Assange's turn.
Well, what we've shown today is that no one is above the law. Julian Assange is no hero. He's hidden from the truth for years and years.
After 7 years of asylum in the Ecuadorian embassy in London, WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange seems headed to trial in the USA. What's in store for Assange? Let's ask someone who himself served 4 years in prison on, among other charges, hacking. Barrett Brown is an activist, an award-winning journalist, and author of, among other books, the forthcoming My Glorious Defeats, Hacktivist, Narcissist, Anonymous.
On this edition of Parallax Views, whistleblower, journalist, former Anonymous associate, and activist, Barrett Brown of the Pursuance Project joins us to discuss this story of uncovering massive corruption in the age of the surveillance state. From his association with the hackers of Anonymous to his eventual targeting by the United States federal government. Brown's case is one that gained national media attention, so So much so, in fact, that it even served as a plot point in an episode of the hit TV drama House of Cards. In January 2015, Brown was sentenced to 63 months in federal prison. However, Brown would be released from prison early on November 29th, 2016. And since then, Barrett has resumed his practice of being a no-holds-barred, take-no-prisoners, journalistic gadfly. Barrett has a great many thoughts he wants to share, specifically in light of the arrest of WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and The Intercept's shutdown of the Edward Snowden archive. Needless to say, Barrett Brown is none too happy with the current state of things, especially in regards to journalism. Barrett Brown speaks with me candidly about all of this and more, as well as filling us in on his latest endeavor, the Pursuance Project, which seeks to succeed where Brown has felt WikiLeaks has failed in the fight for transparency. This is Barrett Brown, Unleashed and Uncensored. And now, on to the conversation with whistleblower, journalist, gadfly, Barrett Brown of the Pursuance Project. Welcome to Parallax Views, Barrett Brown of the Pursuance Project.
Thank you for having me.
So, Barrett, maybe for my listeners that are not as familiar with your work, although I assume they would be, but I always have newbie listeners, maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about yourself. You're a hot rod for controversy.
Indeed. I was a fairly standard freelance rider in my 20s, and then around late 2010... having founded a group called Project PM that I was trying to use to create a new kind of information sharing platform. I actually ended up getting involved in Anonymous when the Tunisian Revolution began. Anonymous did this very really extraordinary assistance campaign to the Democratic Revolution there via some of its members who were Tunisian nationals. And I got involved in that, and then it went from there into this this running battle with various intelligence contracting companies like Booz Allen Hamilton and Palantir and HB Gary and all that. And a year later, I was in prison. The case itself was very it helped to illustrate a lot of the problems we face. It helped to illustrate the DOJ's dangerous disregard for the rights of journalism and the rights to share information. It's really bizarre tendency to make examples out of anyone seen as a whistleblower or anyone seen as threatening national security by revealing wrongdoing among those involved in it. And it was a fruitful affair, and it did help to bring more emphasis again on our original research, which was all about these companies, you know, like Palantir and Booz and Cubic, and what they do and the things they've created over the years that represent a tremendous new threat to democracy.
Well, you know, I think people have become much more familiar with the idea of the surveillance state and, you know, even the sort of cyber military industrial complex. Where do you think as a society we stand on those issues?
Well, unfortunately, although these things crop up every once in a while, particularly with the last election and the role that Cambridge Analytica and its parent company SCL and Palantir and Archimedes played in undermining that election by, you know, data mining Facebook and then using that to create very, very high-end propaganda output directed at certain audiences,
That came out. Whistleblower Christopher Wiley told Bert Carlin about it. Became a story for a little while, and it's kind of been forgotten since then. And so the environment that we're operating in, given the press's shortfalls, given just and that coupled with all the other issues, you know, involving Trump and all that, that kind of take up a lot of the oxygen, it's made it very difficult to drum up the kind of sustained, focused attention that society needs if it's going to address this problem, which goes well beyond what most people might imagine. And that's something that really frightens me more than anything else. Just the fact that we can all go to jail for you know, leaking information or just in my case, just for helping to research information. We can you know, be countered via various illicit, sometimes illegal means by the DOJ or the GCHQ or NSA and the various contractors that are under even less scrutiny and under less oversight. But in the end, all we can do is put the information out there and try to explain it. It's the press itself that needs to be taking the ball and running with it. And so given that Palantir, for instance, to take an example, it's a more well-known company these days than it was 10 years ago.
That's Peter Thiel's company, right?
It is indeed. And given that it was exposed in 2011 via this hack by Anonymous that is what really brought the FBI to my doorstep in the first place, given that all of these things were exposed back then and they were shown to be going after journalists, going after activists in the U.S., very mainstream activist groups, on behalf of their clients, Bank of America and U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and given that the DOJ facilitated this and that this was widely reported back then. And then given that, you know, the New York Times eventually about 2 weeks later, you know, ran a kind of a summary of what happened, you know, regarding Palantir and all that. And then some years after that, in 2018, when the revelations come about regarding Palantir having worked with Cambridge Analytica and its parent company and Archimedes, which shares executives with Cambridge and its parent company. And the New York Times doesn't even remember what it reported on Palantir last time. That's really extraordinary. That's extraordinary shortfall. You know, Palantir in 2011 used this excuse regarding these very really deranged and indefensible plots that they had come up with Palantir, In-Game Systems, and Barrico. Their excuse was that, oh, this was a single staffer and this wasn't approved and we're very unhappy with it. And they called Glenn Greenwald and apologized. He was one of those targeted because of his support for WikiLeaks. You know, and then, you know, a few months later, after they said that we're putting this employee on leave and we're going to discipline him, and that employee is actually promoted. And then a few years later, New York Times reports on its Palantir's latest excursion, which involves undermining an actual U.S. presidential election. And Palantir uses the exact same excuse and blames it again on another staffer. That right there should be enough to get people to understand that we need reform in the press and that needs to come from the outside and it has to be systematic and it has to be assertive. But there's much more than that. But that's just one of the most really extraordinary examples I can provide of how badly they failed, even with the warning signs we had back then, and how badly they continue to fail.
Well, it seems like regardless of the patterns that crop up when it comes to both private and government surveillance, there's always these denials, and I feel like the media politico complex, as some have called it, don't really hold anyone's feet to the fire.
Exactly, that's exactly true. And they also there's all these tendencies in the press that are very pronounced, like, you know, deciding that a story is over based on chronological aspects because, oh, we've been reporting on it and it's been a couple of weeks and now it's over. That doesn't work when you're dealing with something like the H.P. Gary affair, which resulted in the leaking of 75,000 emails between all of these contracting firms and between the NSA and the FBI, the DOJ, and you know, firms like In-Game Systems, which no one had heard of and which were engaged in an extraordinary, entirely different set of criminal activities that were later exposed. When you have that and people are finding a few things, the low-hanging fruit, by searching through those emails and a few, you know, some programs here and there reporting on it, you haven't gotten to the bottom of it yet. You still got a lot of content left. And when the first thing that people come across within 24 hours is this huge indefensible thing that the press itself acknowledged was obviously newsworthy because it was reported on quite a bit back then, the Team Themis thing that I've been talking about with the Palantir and H.P. Gary and all that, that's something that should tell you we should keep looking through these emails. These are emails are important. This is our first window into not just the public, or not just the private intelligence sector, which we knew nothing about, but also the public intelligence sector and how they intersect and how they operate. And it happened again and again with the Stratfor emails, which eventually went to WikiLeaks. That's what I was eventually charged over, because I didn't want to really go into HP Gary that much or Palantir. There was about 2.4 million emails yielded from that, going over back for 10 years. And Stratfor was not itself a competently run firm. It was not the shadow CIA that USA Today used to call it, nor did we ever think it was, those of us who were involved in this. But it was something that it was a company that was very well positioned and spoke to huge numbers of people around the world on a clandestine basis, and also did indefensible criminal activities with the FBI. And for instance, they spied on activists in Bhopal who are advocates for those that were maimed or had their loved ones killed in the Union Carbide disaster in the 80s. And they spy on these people, and they do so for Dow Chemical. That's one of the examples of the kind of things that Stratfor does. Another good example that's more domestic is that, you know, they were spying on PETA for Coca-Cola. That itself, you know, kind of interesting, you know, but the most interesting part of it, the thing that really should have gotten people's attention, was that they were working with the FBI on that, and they're telling Coca-Cola, oh yeah, we'll get the FBI and they'll give us their files on PETA. We have the FBI and the DOJ in these cases, both the Stratfor and the HP Gary Palantir deal, acting as a concierge service for private interests against other Americans who are not even accused of committing a crime. That was under the Obama administration. That was not under a far right wing, you know, authoritarian regime. That was under a pretty, you know, centrist, you know, moderate deal. That's how bad the problem is, and the fact that the press was not able to contend with these issues, even when we compiled all this stuff for them and gave them tips sometimes that they could say, we could say, look, this pretend like this is yours, go ahead and run with this, which we did on a couple of occasions. That's difficult for me as somebody who's been a journalist for a long time and someone who's very sort of exercised about these issues. It's hard for me to deal with, quite frankly. It's really terrible.
You know, I'm just curious because I have a lot of guests on from the world of journalism. I feel like it's a very important topic right now because I think journalism is in really dire straits. I'm just curious, what sort of pushed you towards a career in journalism, though?
Originally, I mean, I don't remember everything because my impulse to journalism was very early, like when I was a child, and writing in general. I mean, ultimately, I wanted to have an impact. I didn't want to just write things. I wanted to write things so that other things would happen, so that things would be addressed. And, you know, starting out, you know, when I first started getting stuff published, first started selling articles, you know, to actual, you know, policy publications and all that, my early 20s, I had written as a freelancer, you know, since I was 17. But when I really first started writing things that, you know, you could look at and say, hey, look, here's this problem that he's examined, and here's some information about it that puts it in a different light. Here's this indefensible thing that he's now presented to us. And I started to realize I've accomplished nothing here. I mean, some people have read this now. Now people know that Texas prisons have cut off communications, one of the major communications avenues between inmates and the journalists who are the ones who expose systemic problems in these prisons, particularly in the state of Texas. As you can imagine, the prisons are unusually poorly run. Nothing comes from it. And so, I, you know, maybe years later when I start writing for other bigger publications and have a larger audience, then that's when the impact will come about. And I started to find that it just wasn't true either. And there was a number of reasons for this. Some has to do with the public itself, and some has to do with journalists, and some has to do with editors, and, you know. But I started looking for other avenues, because ultimately I don't want to be a journalist. I want to be someone who addresses civic issues and does so that they're fixed. And that's not – very rarely can a journalist actually do that, even if he's a good journalist, even if this is a courageous, hardworking journalist. I'm not a hardworking journalist myself, but I'm a courageous one. A competent person, you know, there's so much – they are going against such an inertia – that's not a word. They're going against so much inertia and so much just systemic failure. They're going against these things that aren't conscious, aren't the direct result for the most part of conscious action. It's not the problem isn't that there's intelligence agencies running the media in secret, or the problem isn't even necessarily profit or corporate control or any of this thing. These are problems some here and there, but the fundamental problem is which scares me more than if there is one cause, is that this is just how things are. This is how this generation is. It's how the 21st century is. It's kind of been like that for a while, but it's getting worse. And they're all systemic. And that's a hard thing to have to address, but I've been thinking about how you address it for the last 10 years, and that's kind of my focus now, is putting in place something that can grow into a viable solution and start changing this.
Well, I wanted to maybe backtrack real quick, and then we'll talk a little bit about current events. I had to ask you about, I guess, Anonymous, because I think certain media outlets have said that you were like a spokesperson for Anonymous. I believe that you've disputed that. And I think there's a lot of confusion over what Anonymous was or is. I know people like Greg Hoosh who were involved. But I feel like the mainstream media image of it may be a little bit fantastical and maybe missing the point.
I've got a great body of documentation from when I was sort of acting as a press liaison in some ways for certain Anonymous operations like Tunisia and things like that, that really illustrate this problem very well. And the gist of it is that, you know, you're correct. The press has had difficulties properly relaying, not just, you know, things that are poorly known, but things that have already been documented about Anonymous, you know. And so what happened in my case, which also helps to illustrate this, is that first, you know, I was referred to just as Barrett Brown, who was doing this, you know, in the New York Times had an article on our resistance campaign of the Egyptian revolutionaries and the Tunisian revolutionaries, and then mentioned me in passing, not even saying, giving me a title or anything, just saying Barrett Brown, who was helping organize a legal defense for some of those who've been raided in the last couple of days. And then it goes, and then we get to a point where they start seeing me, you know, talking, you know, about these operations that we're involved in, and they start, someone will call me a spokesman, just assuming that's the case. There was one point early on in which I objected via email to one of these journalists at a major outlet and said, no, I'm not a spokesman. And he said, well, that's our policy. And so over time, we begin to see the pattern whereby journalists copy off other journalists. Every journalist assumes that every other journalist is doing a better job of keeping things straight and fact-checking than they are. And so you start to see these references proliferate. And then eventually some of them start to learn that, oh, Anonymous isn't this formal organization where you would have a title like that. And so this guy must just be the self-proclaimed spokesman. And so then we have this very perverse development where the press has proclaimed me spokesperson. Over and over again, and I'm objecting to it, you know, on television, I'm objecting to it in print and interviews on my Twitter account, to the journalists themselves, but ultimately it is decided collectively that I am the self-proclaimed spokesperson and perhaps some kind of charlatan Cagliostro character. And that ended eventually. It ended, you know, pretty much when I was in prison and I started writing for The Intercept, these columns I was doing, and made a very pointed reference to that. And they kind of stopped after that. But it goes to show couple different tendencies here. One is that, they will journalists at major outlets that people tend to think have these omniscient fact checkers. They will absolutely just Google something and see what else has been written about it and just copy off that. And sometimes you can see very, very clear instances of that where a particularly unusual error crops up and then you see it appear somewhere else. Obviously, two different people didn't come to that assumption or conclusion. Independently, obviously someone copied off the other. And so we have a great opportunity because of all this, because of all the documents I have and all the stuff that's actually public, to really, you know, present more systematically, look, here's how it's actually working. And to be fair, Anonymous is a difficult issue to get one's head around, I guess, compared to other issues. But having said that, I can think of a lot of issues that are more complicated, that are more important, and that we can assume are not being handled very well either.
Well, I think the main point, and you can correct me if I'm wrong about this, I don't think Anonymous, from the people I've talked to, was ever necessarily this centralized, as you said, it wasn't a formal thing. It was very informal, and I feel like the media failed to really recognize that. And in ways, I've seen so much revisionism with the chronicles of Anonymous. I mean, I've noted some people recently have sort of just tried to paint it as a right-wing phenomena that spawned the alt-right because of characters like Weave. I don't think that was necessarily the case, though, starting
out. Yeah, it's absolutely not. Weave was never involved in any way at Anonymous. He didn't like Anonymous. He was my personal enemy back in 2011. I had actually known him years prior. This is all before he became a Nazi. I don't think he was even had those sentiments back then, but he certainly didn't express them until I think about 2012, 2013, if I'm remembering correctly. But no, so Anonymous, there's two different errors in looking at Anonymous. One is the idea that it's this formal group that has, like, as Joseph Min at the Financial Times reported, based on what Aaron Barr, the federal contractor, told him, that has a founder and has lieutenants and all that stuff. That's not the case. Nor is it correct to say that Anonymous is everyone and that, you know, blah, blah, and that there's no notes for it. Anonymous, you know, emerged as a sort of in-joke on the 4chan back in 2006, 2007. It was somewhat interchangeable with /B/, the random board there. Over time, because of, frankly, some accidents and just some unusual incidents, it became this identity, became this this kind of nihilist, dadaist prank organization, but again, not an organization. But then, because one of its targets ended up being Hal Turner, a white nationalist radio host.
I was actually just going to mention that. People yeah. don't realize they went after an actual neo-Nazi radio host.
Yeah, you'll be able to understand that. So when it did so, that started a cycle that began where people saw it from the outside and said, oh, this must be an activist organization. Then they come in and get involved with it. And so slowly it becomes an activist movement because of that. It was porous. It had no walls. It had no charter, and so it could become whatever. But between 2008, when the Chainology, when the campaign against Scientology was begun, largely by a small group of people, including Greg Hausch, in a secret IRC room, orchestrated basically from there, which is an interesting story, to 2012 and probably a little bit thereafter, it was basically what you would call a left anarchist or left libertarian, mostly, kind of a movement, and it was focused for the most part, like the things one heard about Anonymous has done this, Anonymous has done that, almost all of them between late 2010 and 2012, almost all of them came out of a IRC server called Anonops, which was where I operated out of. That's where all the, you know, like Sabu and Topiary and all, the Arab Spring, before it was called that, Tunisian Revolution, the Bahrain stuff. All of our work on H.P. Gary and the contracting industry and Strepper, most of that was focused there, and then a little bit was focused on a couple of other smaller servers, including Project PM, which was mine for my group, but still separate. But so basically, the short version is the idea that, you know, everyone is anonymous, we're all anonymous, and blah blah. There are certain places you could have gone in 2011 and said, "Hey, Anonymous, here's this thing, here's this wrong that needs to be righted. Please do it," and nothing's going to happen. There's other places where you could have gone and said, "Hey, Anonymous, is it wrong? It needs to be righted. Here's this information," and things will start happening in about 30 or 40 minutes. That was anonops.irc. So, I mean, it was something that no one had full control over the branding, the concept of what it was. But there were people who had more control than others over that and what it did. And some of those, you know, that was Greg Hausch and a few other people early on. Greg Hausch brought me in to help with some of those things, which is how I took on that sort of press role. Anonymous was always most successful when it did have a degree of centralization, in the sense that there were people that were known and trusted and had a track record of doing things in a certain way that you could go to and say, "Hey, we should do this," and all that. And that was the case more or less, between 2008 and 2011, or 2012, there was generally a group of people, you know, between 5 and 15 that were sort of major nodes, major components of this, that had a degree of soft power, had a degree of, of influence. And in my case, could relay to the press the image and the ideology that I felt should be relayed. It's not a perfect solution, obviously. That's a very imperfect way to approach things. But the alternative was to just have everyone and their 14-year-old cousin sort of going out and doing what those people are capable of doing, which is not very much, which is why, as we see now, we have all these anonymous Facebook accounts, and they have Guy Fawkes mess and all that, and nothing is emerging from it. The right people aren't there, and it's not the right time, and the brand is has been compromised. Again, partly because of this alt-right thing where they have, to some degree, you know, kind of made anonymous its creature to some extent. But, you know, it's you know, and that's a great lesson. I mean, Anonymous had a, because of its nature, because of its jellyfish amorphous nature, it had a lot of advantages. But without an exoskeleton to keep those structures in place, an exoskeleton that can grow with it, it's eventually going to fall prey to its own factors, its own basic nature, and that's what happened.
Well, you know, in that regard, I guess moving out of Anonymous, I think it has created a culture where there's more whistleblowers coming out. Then we all, of course, had WikiLeaks. What do you think the most important sort of developments were that has come out of this sort of hacktivist culture of the 2000s?
I think we mostly have some proof of concepts. You know, we have WikiLeaks that shows, you know, obviously WikiLeaks went bad to some extent starting between, I don't know when it began as such, or when you could say here's when it turned away from its original mission. But from my standpoint, I think I would say that would happen in 2015, 2016, most noticeably, and it was always flawed. It was a flawed model, but WikiLeaks proved a great deal about what could be done these days and what a single person can conceive and execute with assistance if their ideas make sense in a way that was less possible 20 years ago, and totally impossible 40 years ago. And that's important. It's also important to take that lesson. Look, we don't need to have a single person in control in this very non-transparent way, giving secret orders and with his own secret campaign of orchestration, you know, to impose something on the globe. That didn't work. Someone else with more strength than Julian Assange perhaps could have pulled off something desirable in that capacity, but it's generally not the best way to go, I would say. I think it was proven when he was pulled out of the embassy with his beard out and yelling "Resist UK" to people who aren't going to do anything. That model failed. Anonymous proved a great deal. It's a very complicated subject, I think, more so than WikiLeaks because of how decentralized it was. It proved a number of things. I guess the biggest lesson, as I've said, is that a movement, an amorphous thing, an emergent thing, has these extraordinary advantages over institutions. They can react faster. They can bring in huge numbers of people. They can act upon their ideas and better harness the ideas of people who may not be prominent in an institution in a way that institutions can't. But it does need an exoskeleton. It needs something that can grow along with it and give it structure so that there is a common, a base of understanding among its participants about what it's doing, what the values are that it's promoting, how it operates, et cetera. And that's why my focus has been, you know, for the last, you know, probably 7 or 8 years, mostly during PRISM when I thought about this a great deal, in creating something that can serve as an exoskeleton for something more mature than Anonymous, and more long term, and that's what the Pursuance Project is.
Well, I feel like it's almost like we're in stage two of a much bigger story. I think stage one was sort of getting people to realize that there were a lot of these issues at hand. You know, I remember when the whole Snowden scandal first hit involving the NSA. You had those voices that were bootlickers for the establishment that would say, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to worry about. We don't hear that much anymore. I think the realization of what the surveillance state is and what it's capable of has really sunk in part due to your work, Hausch's work, and many others.
I don't think my work, I think my work has definitely brought that to the attention of a minority of and sort of interested parties, well-informed parties who are equipped to follow this and care about it. In the mainstream sense, I don't think it's made a chink in the armor. You're absolutely right regarding how the reaction to Snowden. You had people like Thomas Friedman writing columns back then saying, oh, you know, this guy says he's blowing the whistle, but I'm going to quote the producer of The Wired for three paragraphs on why he thinks it's okay for the surveillance. And basically it was a very simple elementary argument that if you know, why is it a problem? That argument itself is a siphon point in some way, but it's also just inherently false because it's not the average citizen that's going to be targeted with surveillance or that the surveillance is going to be used against. It's the non-average citizen, the one who is the whistleblower, or the activist or the journalist who gets too close to things that the citizenry needs to know. Those are the people who are victimized by these things. And beyond that, surveillance, although obviously undesirable, to me, it's a less important part of the larger picture that involves propaganda, that involves the ability, that's where surveillance and data mining comes in. And suddenly you have these structures, these institutions, whether it be intelligence agencies or private companies or the convergence of those things, like Booz Allen Hamilton, perfect example, which is, of course, where Snowden came out of, which is funny because, you know, we were trying to get people to pay attention to Booz Allen Hamilton back in 2011 and just kind of disregarded on that. Ultimately, the problem is that this information that they're collecting by surveillance, even if it's mom and dad, even if it's a soccer mom who's not doing anything, all that information, when you put it all together, then it becomes very, very useful. That's one of the things Palantir, that's where they come in. That can now be can be refined into output. Output to manufacture events, output to provide propaganda, sort of laundered, you know, via other means that don't look like it's coming from, say, Cambridge Analytica or the Pentagon, by the Romus Coin Program, for instance, which I'll mention later, I suppose. Now you have not just the things we know about coming into play and being used against to end informed consent, to treat the citizenry not as the rulers of a country, but as a factor to be taken into account and manipulated at will, which it always has been to some extent. And then you have you get to a point where they have so much technology that's not necessarily advanced in the sense of, you know, normal sense, but is very well put together and is not the kind of thing that the average person or even the technology journalist is going to be aware of or understand the implications of. But these are people who have a lot of doctrine to work off of. They have a lot of resources. They have a great deal of understanding of the things they've already produced, and they're able to sit there for years and years being paid for it to think up, how can we use this information in a weaponized way? And the fact that a lot of people like Thomas Friedman can't imagine how that might come back to haunt them is obviously, besides the point, it's irrelevant. For Thomas Friedman, I think, could have learned a valuable lesson last year when his good friend was murdered by the Saudis, because his good friend was tracked by one of these intelligence contractors the hours before he was killed. Now, that's not enough to teach Thomas Friedman that he needs to stay out of these issues. But, you know, it's a good illustration for everybody else.
Well, you know, it's interesting you mentioned the Romus coin surveillance contract. Maybe you could tell my listeners a little bit about that, because you released an exclusive report on it with Project PM. I guess it was basically data mining that was targeting Arab countries in 2011.
Yes, so this was something that it's one of the other great illustrations of how the press has failed us. The information on Romus coin came mostly out of the H.P. Gary emails, you know, that I've been going through. This is about 6 or 7 months after they come out, and of course most of the press is forgotten it. I put it out for The Guardian, a little article summarizing it, and then wrote a long report on Project PM, linked to there, and it got very little pickup. Lieutenant Colonel Anthony Schaefer, who had revealed the Able Danger thing, you know, he came out and basically endorsed my thinking on this and said, yeah, this is extraordinarily important. And Ross Story did a piece. Ross Story was actually really, really good back then on these issues. Probably still is, I don't know. Der Spiegel, I think, you know, and besides that, it was basically nothing. And this is a program that involved Apple and Google having meetings, their national security divisions, named staffers at Apple and Google, meeting with Aaron Barr, who had just been disgraced and his company, H.P. Gary Federal, liquidated because he had been caught digging up information on the children of activists and of labor leaders and of targeting journalists and of all these other things that, you know, they didn't get in trouble for. And along with him and a couple other people from TASC and some of the more traditional firms, they were working on a recompete for Romus Coin, which actually Aaron Barr had named when he was at Northrop Grumman. And what it was, it was many things. It involved a number of companies. It involved a huge number of specialty firms doing things like natural linguistics, even cell phone game firms. And we never understood the full mechanism, because these emails and documentation there, generally the policy is they don't go into a lot of specifics, but we are able to determine like what it consists of, what kind of technologies it uses, what sort of people and companies are relevant to it. And ultimately, it's pretty clear that this was a data mining project that, you know, sucked in data, huge amounts of data, had it processed in a way that makes it very, very usable for these people, and then puts out a propaganda output component. There's definitely an output component that's discussed, and that output could be a number of means. You know, again, one of probably the game companies would come in terms of input, I would imagine, but who knows? And then suddenly, so you have this thing that, you know, it's all the more dangerous by virtue of the fact that few people understand that these things happen. And it's all the more egregious because two of the companies involved in this, Archimedes Archimedes and H.P. Gary. Archimedes was at that time and would remain a very close partner of Cambridge Analytica and SCL. And so had someone picked up on this, I said, you know, someone could have been Glenn Greenwald, who I sent all this information, or Adrian Chin, who I sent all this information, who's now at the New York Times and is their expert on online propaganda. The 2016 election could have gone a different way because it would not have been undermined by these same companies. You know, Archimedes, Palantir, and Cambridge Analytica and its parent company, SCL, were the ones who, of course, as we, you know, have seen, was revealed to have done this same thing. They used something very similar to the Romas coin and something very similar to Project Titania, which Max Blumenthal discovered last year using my research on Romas coin. They used it against the American people. And even though this has come out and these firms have been caught again, the press has no institutional memory, it seems, for the most part. And this is something they don't really want to address because it looks worse the closer you get. When you look at who I told about this, and when you look at who not just disregarded it, ignored it, but actually mocked it and attacked it while I was a prisoner under a gag order, which is what Adrian Chin did for Gawker, way before he was a New Yorker staff writer, way before he was a New York Times contributor, way before he was writing for The Nation, and way before he was writing for a few other outlets, a New York magazine, which he still writes for. This guy was doing everything he could to discredit me. It was really bizarre. And then he later, having shown no interest at all previous to that in these issues, started writing about Trapwire and things like that in early 2012, with the intent apparently of telling everyone it was no big deal and then putting out information that was incorrect, that we'd already shown to be incorrect. And then goes on to this career that involves being that resident expert that American people are supposed to go to regarding, you know, these same issues. There's a number of reasons why, because of what happened back then, that the press, even to the extent that they're aware of it, and a lot of them are aware of it now because I've been making them aware of it, sometimes very publicly, it's not in their interest, in terms of individual careerism, to address this. So I have to address it myself for the most part. But it's a story that's important enough. It's not really about me and just sort of me, you know, being right about everything and being wrong to know what was in, you know, everyone should give me a pat on the back, which they should. But it's about the victimization of the American public by press careerists who don't understand these issues and who have no mechanism, no accountability when they fail. And this was a huge failure. This wasn't something that resulted in 100 deaths somewhere or something that will waste taxpayer money. This is something that fundamentally strikes at democracy. It strikes at informed consent. It makes informed consent virtually impossible. And it's, you know, someone from Archimedes, one of their top executives, kind of rambling now, but just I should add this, one of their top executives who was also an executive at Cambridge Analytica, after the election, joined the Trump administration in the National Security Division. That's what's happening. And, you know, they're winning, and there's no reason to believe that left to their own devices, the press or the Congress, for that matter, are going to address this, which is why this is going to be addressed, and it has to be if we're going to remain anything other than a subject population under a sort of a half-hidden oligarchy that's not even that secret. These have to be addressed very assertively on a large scale over the next few years.
Well, I think when it comes to the press, I feel like we live in a very, very strange time because I'm not a fan of right-wing tabloid media like InfoWars or the Drudge Report. But, you know, the sort of legacy or, if you want to call it, establishment press, they've failed over and over again. I can't figure out why someone like Thomas Friedman still has a job after being wrong about things like Iraq. I can't understand why David Frum or a William Kristol, these old neocons, are now sort of being allowed to be the never-Trumper guys when, you know, they couldn't even prevent their own party getting taken over by nativists. But it seems so incestuous at this point. There's so much access journalism and so many people that are tied to power that you can't get rid of these people.
Yeah, everyone is friends, and they're reluctant. When you make friends, you want his reluctance to hold them to account, and that's why I think journalists should not be making friends with anyone that it matters, ever. Or they should be ready to turn on them on a dime like I am. It's egregious. I mean, yeah, everything you just listed is exactly what the focus should be. It's unfortunate that, of course, you know, the right wing, particularly Trump, you know, in the last few years has attacked the press on these oftentimes ridiculous, you know, on things that are just wrong. Like, you know, they have attacked the press for the wrong reasons. That makes it harder to drum up a campaign of reform from the outside, because without explaining it with a couple sentences at least, which is hard to do on Twitter, which is the main, I guess, venue for our national conversation now, it's hard not to turn off, I guess, centrist Democrats or is anyone who opposes Trump based on the idea that, look, the press is under assault by the Trump administration. We need to stand behind it, whatever. If the dichotomy becomes, as it has in the last few years, between the establishment and expertise versus like populism, then that's a difficult thing to articulate the nuances. It's unfortunate that the establishment press has managed to attach itself, this package deal, where it's defending expertise, supposedly. And meanwhile, the Trump people, you know, are presented as, and many times are, the ones who don't care about expertise and are thus, you know, trying to bring us into a world of non-facts and propaganda, when the truth is more complicated. The truth is that the press opened itself up to reasonable charges of its failures by first opening itself up to unreasonable charges. As in, had they not screwed up on the actual things they actually screwed up on over and over again, it would be harder for a lot of these people who have emerged to have made these false cases about what else they've screwed up on. And again, had the press itself respected expertise, which it has generally not, it would be a much better standard bearer for, you know, reality than it is now. And so it's a difficult, just like with the WikiLeaks situation, and you know, all of this, frankly, there's these dichotomies that are not, which both sides are partly wrong. And so it's very hard to come into the conversation without being associated immediately with one of those dichotomies. So if you say, look, you know, the press said this and that Trump did, but of course Bush did the same thing and so did Obama and some of them did it worse, some of this stuff isn't new, then the first impulse, for a lot of people that observe that, are going to say, oh, this guy must be a Trump supporter. And same thing in the opposite. If I say, yeah, Assange is a liar and a frankly a scumbag in ways that aren't even ways that even go beyond what's now public, then they think, oh, he loves Clinton. And people have said that. They said, oh, I guess you like the NSA and the FBI, which, as you may probably understand, I do not. But it's a difficult time. There's no nuance. There's I mean, to an extent that's unusual even for America, and that's a difficult time to make nuanced pronouncements and policy proposals. But it has to be done, and there are ways that it can be done. It just requires a little bit of ingenuity.
Well, I mean, in that regard, it's interesting. I wanted to get a little bit into your thoughts on Assange, but first I wanted to note something about the way WikiLeaks has been covered by the media, you know, for the past decade now. I feel like the media doesn't really want to talk about the information gleaned by WikiLeaks. It's more about Julian Assange, and I think that's in part due to Julian Assange sort of wanting to set himself up as a media rock star, and I could be wrong about that. That's just the sort of intuition I have. And I also think the media wants to do that because that kind of soap opera where, you know, oh, Pamela Anderson went to the embassy to meet with Julian Assange today, I think in a lot of ways they feel like that's what sells, and we're not getting the stories that mattered with regards to WikiLeaks.
Yeah, of course. Whenever something emerges, the press's tendency is to find a figurehead, find a persona that is more interesting to humans, to their readers, than is, you know, the things behind it, the things being done, the actual meat there. And that's what happened with Assange, and it happened to me to some extent as well. Sometimes that's our fault. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's a combination. But yeah, and that's their inclination. And they justify it by saying, well, you know, I'm a reporter and I'm an editor, and you know, we have to get people to read the things, and so we do this, and then we'll put in some important stuff here and there as well. That's generally justification. Of course, it's partly true. It's also partly false, which, like everything else these days, the press did not do a very extraordinary job, in my opinion, of covering WikiLeaks and explaining what it is. They're doing an even worse job now. With this indictment of him and Chelsea Manning for trying to crack a password on materials that Manning leaks to him that were in the public interest, that were obviously provided as a whistleblower, regardless of if you even think Assange is a journalist, which I don't, as I've said, I think there's very few people around right now who can be trusted to make that determination. And the DOJ certainly is not among those people. And a lot of the press that I've dealt with are definitely not. Now we have a situation where we have to defend the rights of Assange, who I would quite happily, you know, I basically told him to hang himself on TV last week ago. I didn't say it outright, but I kind of implied that maybe that would be the best decision. But to defend his rights, because the DOJ will use this, just as they tried to use my case, as a new mechanism to establish a new precedent that will allow them to punish dissent, both in journalism and activism and just citizenry in general, while allowing those who support the FBI, essentially support the state and are anti-activist, anti-information transparency, to commit much more demonstrable crimes with very little justification and go free. Adrian Chen, you know, for instance, again, there's two different case files from two different discoveries, from two different federal trials, mine and Jeremy Hammond's, that shows him engaging in what would have absolutely made it into my indictment or emerged in a separate indictment on its own, had I done them or had anyone else who was a dissident done them. That includes telling me in 2011, suggesting that in the Op Manning campaign, where we were trying to bring attention to Manning's torture, that we dox, you know, find the identifying information of and then publish U.S. Marines at Quantico and the Pentagon. That, for some reason, has not prevented him from being a citizen in good standing as far as the FBI is concerned, nor has the fact that he tried to buy stolen emails or what he thought to be stolen emails from another news outlet that Sabu, while he was an FBI agent, Hector Montsegur, or FBI informant, Sabu and Lolsek and all these guys said they had, which they were doing just to string him along. And so Adrian Chen, along with almost certainly his editors at Gawker, who were 100% absolutely going to be aware of this, since Adrian Chen was talking about using Gawker's money for it and offering Gawker servers, Adrian Chen offered to buy stolen emails from the same FBI informant from my case, and the same FBI informant that approached WikiLeaks trying to sell them the Stratford emails around that same time. Hector Montsegur, who was known as Sabu, a very prominent anonymous anti-sec lulzsec hacker, and his crew. He offered them money from Gawker for the emails that he believed had been hacked and stolen from another news outlet, News of the World. He offered them use of Gawker's servers, and he encouraged them and kind of cajoled them into doing this when, you know, over this two-week period in which he was engaged in these negotiations, when they seemed reluctant. And that would have constituted a criminal conspiracy for which one would be indicted by the FBI had anyone done it who was not someone like Adrian Chen, not someone who had, I should say someone who was pliable. There's two possibilities here. One is that, you know, the FBI just didn't prosecute him because he's useful to them, because he wrote all of these articles that were oftentimes included just bizarre fabrications, very easily demonstrable fabrications about activists, about Anonymous, about Occupy Wall Street in some cases, and just went on to do this over and over again in this very bizarre way that I've never seen There's nothing I compare it to. And I've dealt with hundreds of journalists, and I was a press critic before I was involved in a lot of this, you know, for years, and that's my main focus, and it still is. Never seen behavior like Adrian Chen's, and it could be explainable by Adrian Chen's own, you know, whatever strange psychology. But as we get into the next 7 or 8 years, it starts to become more concerning. But just to finish the point, if Adrian Chen can do that, and he can also proffer, can kind of encourage me and Anonymous to engage in this other criminal conspiracy. And meanwhile, Chelsea Manning is being indicted again, this time for trying to break a code on leaks she's already, you know, been convicted in military court for providing. Then we have a problem. We have a situation in which, A, the DOJ will absolutely and has weaponized the statutes to punish dissent, and is deciding based on content who is going to be prosecuted, including me. And B, given that I've been talking about the, given that this came out in 2014, but Andrew Blake and Dan Stuckey wrote it up for the Daily Dot using files, transcripts from the discovery from Jeremy Hammond's case. And this has been ignored since. And even though I've talked about it for the last year, and have done so quite a bit in the last few weeks, and even burned my National Magazine Award a few days ago while presenting information yet again. And it's still been ignored by all of his old editors, including the ones at the New Yorker, who I've sent emails to and left phone messages for and talked to and corresponded with, giving them this information along with quite a bit else. And they're still not willing to come out and say, hey, you know, we know of information that is of obviously great relevance to this debate about journalism and WikiLeaks and leaking. We're going to put it out here. We should have mentioned it earlier. And the fact that John Cook knew of this, he definitely knew of it at the very least. If he somehow did not know about this in 2011 when it happened, he definitely knew about it in 2014 when he was called for comment and gave comment to Daily Dot about this incident. He did so about a month before I was sentenced. And rather than come forward and say, hey, you guys are apparently sentencing Barrett Brown to $900,000 in restitution to Stratfor and some more time in prison for calling Stratfor, their executives, when this same FBI informant, Sabu, was talking about dumping all these emails they had just stolen and calling them and offering to help redact anything sensitive in those emails because he'd gotten Sabu and the other hackers to agree to that because Barrett Brown was concerned about what might happen if this was all dumped. And he's about to be tried for it. And meanwhile, I was there at Gawker where my buddy Adrian Chen, as I now definitely know based on these trial discovery, did something that was actually illegal, you know, that wasn't a last resort charge by the DOJ that we had to offer them when they needed something to hit me with a Stratfor. I'm going to come forward with that. And the thing is, Quinn Norton of Wired, who had linked to the same file that I was originally indicted linking to, where I was originally facing 22 years for linking to, she testified for my defense at those hearings. And she was threatened with a charge by the prosecutor right there at the bench conference. She stood up for journalism and for the rights of internet users to link to information because she believed it was important to do so, had the courage to do so. And John Cook did not, Adrian Chen did not, and the other editors there and everyone else who knows about this did not. And I think that tells us that no, we don't need people at The Atlantic or New York or New York Times. I understand a lot of them are defending Assange's rights, which is great, but nonetheless, we don't need them making these determinations. I remember quite well being written that I was not really a journalist back after my arrest. And a few years later, I won the National Magazine Award, the National Press Club Award, New York Press Club Award, and then about a year after that, Folio Award for Best Local Coverage. That's a lot of awards for a journalist, someone who wins is not a journalist. So I know from experience, and anyone else can know if they want to look at the documentation, that this whole thing is a fraud. I mean, it's gotten to that point where it's beyond disgusting. It's frankly criminal in some ways. And every single editor, including those of the New Yorker, who knows about this, and The Nation, who ran an article by Chen about Sabu and is anonymous that didn't even mention, oh, whoops, I tried to buy stolen emails from. They are all culpable in this. And it's extraordinary the links I've had to go to bring this to attention while Chelsea Manning is once again sitting in prison.
Well, I think a lot of the press is playing a very, very dangerous game at this point because, I mean, you know, when we're talking about, well, what determines what a journalist or a publisher is, you know, that I think can come back to haunt the press in a lot of ways.
Absolutely. And I think the fact that a lot of these, you know, things were going down in the Obama administration, and meanwhile you've got people like Thomas Friedman saying, oh, don't worry about this, blah, blah. And then a couple years later, we elect an authoritarian right-wing, just deranged figure, and he's president. You know, we're not having to worry about 20 years down the line, maybe something will happen, there'll be some other change, and all of these apparatuses that have been created and used and abused are now under his control. We don't have to, like, worry about that. It's already happened. Now, luckily, the way the intelligence community works, I mean, I say luckily, but it's a better option than Trump having it, is, you know, they don't take direction from the president. They don't want to. They don't, you know, they're not really under that much oversight effectively by Congress or the public or press. So they, you know, Trump could not, in this case, use these things illicitly like he would want to, because they would balk at it and it would be reported and they're trying to get rid of them. So that's a nice, you know, I suppose a nice eventuality. But next time it could be someone whose views are much more in line with the intelligence community and who is not openly ridiculous and who is more savvy about his criminality than Trump is. And more to the point, again, centrist president Obama, you know, fairly, as far as presidents go, fairly good in some ways. Transformative figure that everyone was very fond of. Everyone, you know, who's not, was a Republican for the most part. He couldn't be depended upon to use responsibly, and neither could the Eric Holder DOJ. That becomes clearer and clearer when you look at Aaron Swartz facing 20 years and killing himself. It becomes very clear when you see my case. When you see everything that we exposed and was not addressed, including the Team Themis thing, in which the DOJ, you know, facilitated a criminal operation and then got caught. That should have been enough. And the fact that it wasn't means that there's a number of conversations that need to be had. And beyond those conversations, I would say those conversations would be merely just for the purpose of recruiting enough people who were able to put in place more mechanisms that will hold the press to account and hold the government to account, and do so via information operations in a transparent way that will be hard to ignore. That's the only way to do it. They will ignore everything they can. Anyone who looks at how things went with my case and how I was dealt with by the press originally, and some of these more outlier incidents like Adrian Chen, I think it would be hard for them to say everything's all right and we'll definitely be ready for the next time some companies decide to undermine the election in favor of an authoritarian. I think that's a hard argument to make, which is why they don't make it. It's why they can't address these things.
Well, I guess before briefly covering your thoughts on The Intercept, I just wanted to give you a chance to give your final thoughts on maybe this whole Assange affair, so to speak.
So he, you know, as I said, he was one of several figures back, you know, 10 years ago who were very inspiring, and that he's basically the reason I got into a lot of this stuff. I was already doing Project PM before I knew about him, but it definitely helped to, you know, clarify, you know, my thoughts and provide a lot of, again, these proof of concepts of what can be done. He was a figure who was always going to fail on this. He did not have the emotional and intellectual kind of the makeup for this kind of thing. And it's obviously he was pushed. I mean, he was a very different person way back then than he was just a few years later, after a couple of years of being in the embassy and seeing this press coverage. I mean, the guy was pursued not for the things he'd done wrong, but the things he was doing right from the very get-go, and was pursued in a number of different ways by companies like Booz Allen Hamilton that the press, you know, they were never reported except for by me and, you know, a few other people, not paid attention to at any rate. He was a subject of a great deal of intrigue and propaganda and just absolutely just, you know, press incoherence, just false, you know, not maliciousness always, but, you know, incompetence. He was someone who, you know, was targeted with that, had to contend with that. And over the years, he went crazy. He became a deranged figure. He became sort of a, you know, I mean, very evocative when you saw him pulled out of there, very evocative Howard Hughes in some ways.
So you don't feel that he was necessarily, there's this picture that people paint of him now that he was simply a sort of mercenary figure, maybe working with Russia or something like that. Do you feel that that's sort of a smear?
I think it's I think it is in some ways premature. I think a lot of people who are saying that aren't equipped to say that. Having said that, I do know people in journalism and in this sector, what we might call it, of transparency activism that have alluded to that and do think it's quite possible. I'm agnostic on that issue. I mean, there were some dealings. I mean, he had with Russia. How far back those dealings go and what the intent was originally and how he met, to what extent this was something he was doing consciously and to what extent he was using as a mechanism to achieve his own goals. These are all things that will have to be kind of assessed over time. But I do think that early on, I think that the people who knew him very close, people who were very close to him back in the day, some of whom are now my board of directors and others aren't, but I'm in communication with them. They tend to paint a picture that differs from that, including his people who are his detractors now. They don't tend to paint that picture. It doesn't mean it's not true. It just means that if I'm not ready to make that assessment, then most of the people in the press who were saying otherwise, they're not ready to make it, and never will be.
I was just going to say real quick, it's also secondary to what this case represents. I mean, this is a war on transparency.
Yes, and that's the problem. Yeah, and it's unfortunate that he should be the figure that we have to have had to rally around for so long. I was in some way. I mean, I was troubled to see, and I'm very rarely troubled, I guess, by things like that. I don't use the word troubled very often, but seeing that video of him being pulled out, it was difficult. But at the same time, as I said, then in the immediate aftermath, when I made a little talk on it, it's good that this is passing now. Because now this very important movement and these very important issues no longer have to be centralized and tainted by their association with this figure, this person who was not equipped for it. This is somebody who's lied over and over again about very important issues. His people close to him, the people who have come to revolve his court that's emerged in the last few years as they pushed out the much more competent, much more moral people who used to advise him. They have lied and or engaged in just bizarre, counterproductive strategies and tactics. And we've seen that recently when he was pulled out unexpectedly. I knew Assange was going to be arrested 2 weeks before he was. So did a few other people. And I made that public. They should have known. But they were holding a press conference trying to talk about suing over surveillance the day before he was arrested. I mean, the people who were around him have no idea what they're doing. And in fact, when you have Kim.com involved, that massive fraud. And you have Susie Dawson, who not very well known, but she was head of the internet party that Kim.com funded, and she's overseeing a lot of these fundraising and support efforts. These people are insane, and they're deranged, and they're grifters to some extent. And when you have those kind of people around you, because they're yes men, and they'll give you loyalty no matter what you do, because their loyalty is to a person eventually, not a cause, this is what you get. You have this very sorry picture. As we did last, when he was pulled out of the embassy.
Well, I mean, even looking at the Twitter feed of WikiLeaks and how it has changed over the years. I mean, it went from, covering very important stuff to devolving into this stuff about Pizzagate and spirit cooking.
Yeah. And the commenters, I mean, the constituency they had 10 years ago was a very, next few years after that was a very, it's a great constituency. It was a lot of people you want to have as supporters. These were people who were idealists, but who were also, in many cases, very savvy. I mean, you had this huge constituency that was ready to embrace a ongoing and assertive, self-confident movement against institutional corruption, against institutional criminality. That's all squandered all of a sudden. And then suddenly his followers are people who collect angel figurines and shit. Trump supporters, alt-right people, people for whom Trump is too centrist for their tastes. You have crazy far left people who are basically consistent apologists for authoritarian regimes. People who are just not able to articulate an argument or handle an argument, which is why in the few days before Assange was arrested, one of the things he seems to have spent his time on was ordering whoever's running the WikiLeaks Twitter to block my account. That's literally that's the kind of thing he was concerned with. Yeah, and that's less surprising when you consider that, last year in August, he ordered, he summoned Naomi Colvin, who was the director of the Courage Foundation, to the embassy and complained about me because I had been, of course, been criticizing him in ways that are very hard for him, for any of his supporters to deal with, given what I did and given what I was in prison for and given what is on the WikiLeaks site, you know, in my praise still, harangued her about me and said, I want him cut off from the Courage Foundation. I was a beneficiary of this nonprofit that he and Sarah Harrison had set up years ago to help whistleblowers. I didn't even receive any money from the Courage Foundation anymore. In fact, of the $14,000 that was given directed to me after the Free Barrett Brown legal fund was merged in the Courage Foundation after my sentencing, of the $14,000, I got about $3,000. And then I was asked when I got out, can the rest of this, even though I have these restitution costs still, can the rest of this go into the common fund for other beneficiaries? And I said, sure. So he gained nothing, not even a few thousand dollars for the other beneficiaries by cutting me off. What he did was prompt Naomi Colvin to resign from the Courage Foundation, prompt me to arrange for this all to be published in the Daily Beast, and have her leave his circle and join Pursuance, my group, on the board of directors. Very public humiliation that almost certainly made things worse for him emotionally. And it could have been avoided. And it's not just that he was doing this. John Pilger, who is this Australian journalist who I guess used to be very respected, I'm sure has done some great work, who is a amoral, bizarre figure these days, you know, he allowed this. He did this. He allowed this to happen. When Naomi Colvin wouldn't do it, you know, the board did it. And when I say the board, I mean the few people that actually run the board. The rest, like John Kiriakou, who is also on my board of directors, they had not informed of this. And so, again, this is an illustration of the people who are around him have failed him, and they don't understand it. And there's been a struggle, you know, off and on, and then it's emerged again recently, to get some of these people who were protecting Assange from himself, basically, and giving him good counsel, get them back in control of this now that, you know, press rights and America's empire, now these issues are on the table and there's a lot at stake, to get these people who know what they're doing back in control of what needs to be done. But instead, no, we have the Australian faction and New Zealand faction still in control because they've managed to express more loyalty to Assange. And that's a great way to ruin a movement.
Well, I want to say for my listeners, you were the first one to really take note that Assange was going to be taken out of the embassy. And anyone who wants to look into that, I mean, your Facebook posts are pretty public. They can see that you were calling this very early on.
Yeah, well, the Vice, after WikiLeaks announced, so I've been told about a week and a half before WikiLeaks announced that they've been heard from someone in the embassy that is about to be expelled, and I heard this from a journalist who was going over there, and she heard it from the law enforcement agencies in the U.S. involved. They were basically bragging about it at that point. There's been some scares before about, oh, he's about to get kicked out of the embassy. I remember I was going to the Chris Hedges program last year when one of these scares came up. And here comes a fire engine. We recorded two intros that Chris wanted to do, one if he was arrested the next day and one if he wasn't, because he wasn't sure. And a lot of people thought, you know. But it wasn't until this incident where I heard this particular thing that I really thought, okay, he's definitely getting arrested. So the timing makes sense. All of that. And there's a Vice article in which I say, will Assange be arrested? You know, no one really knows, and quotes me and quotes a few other people. Originally, they had to correct that article because they had said that I'd heard it from my sources that a journalist said. But of course, I'd heard it from the journalist directly. I would not have put as much stock into it had I not. You know, I'm also a journalist. They had to make a few other corrections. It was cute. But I think the fact, you know, as I said, at some point, people need to start listening to me, you know, about these things. I think I've been pretty consistently correct about what's going to happen in each of these cases. And I think that's a good example. But it's not something it would be in good form for me to go about bragging about myself right now. But it goes back to this larger issue of expertise. There are certain things in which certain people, some of which I know who are researchers or journalists, have exhibited expertise in the sense that they have been able to make predictions that are useful, just like in science. You know, their hypothesis has been correct and thus useful. And they are not they're not the go-to people for those. You know, the go-to people are the ones who have, you know, somehow gotten in these positions and whatever exhibits itself. So the best example is Aaron Gallagher, who was one of the first Americans to be researching these propaganda bots. Not persona management, exactly the thing. used to focus on, but you know, these very blunt, low end Twitter bots. You know, that actually, she knows she studied it because this is a major thing in Mexican politics and in Latin American politics for a number of years before it hit the U.S. actually, and she learned it from a lot of Mexican researchers. But she's quoted a bunch. But meanwhile, you have this guy that CNN did a profile on. You know, and the headline is, you know, or the shh, dog, be quiet. We're talking about important issues. Aaron Gallagher has exhibited expertise over and over again on this issue of propaganda bots on Twitter. And then meanwhile, last year you had CNN and other outlets focusing on this guy, Josh something. I've forgotten his name now. But if you just Google, you know, father Russian trolls, you'll find this article CNN did, and the first line is like, when this father of two tucks the kids in bed at night, he hunts for Russian trolls. And at the end, you know, he says, oh, he gets death threats. And he's like, I don't worry about them. I just send him a picture of my gun when I get them. And this guy has repeatedly misidentified known bot networks of you know, propaganda trolls on Twitter over and over again. And Aaron Gallagher has like publicly pointed out, no, look, here's where it's actually been. This was found several years ago, and here's where it's actually from. It's blah, blah. You know, and this guy was a go-to guy. Even after the thing he's involved with, that group that was caught by the New York Times late last year, creating bots, saying they were Russian bots, and then, you know, making them public and saying, look, we found these bots, and then we're involved in the World War campaign. Even after that was exposed a few months later, that same organization and this same guy who was involved with them still being quoted as experts by NBC. Really, you know, it goes back to what you said about, you know, it's compartmentalized, it's fragmented. There's nothing that can be so public and so well documented that it's going to be accessible or accessed at any rate by the people who should be accessing it. And so it's never enough to put out information. It's never enough to be right. It's never enough to be right consistently. It's never enough to make a case. It's never enough to bring to attention of these outlets that they've done something wrong, that they've made errors, that they're employing someone who's engaged in fabrications. It's never enough. It has to be repeated over and over again. And that's the problem that has to be addressed first and foremost before anything else is going to get fixed.
Well, you know, I guess that brings us to, you know, your work lately. You've been very critical lately of The Intercept, which has become a sacred cow for many people who believe in transparency issues. I've always been a little bit wary of some aspects of The Intercept, mainly its funding by Pierre Omidyar. But what is your critique personally of The Intercept?
My first critique was an internal one when I was in, you know, prison and writing columns for them, and dealt with these editors and was not always happy with some of the changes. You know, that's pretty common. Gradually, towards the end of my sentence, I wrote my last column for The Intercept. Wasn't intended to be the last column, but and I tried to talk about Ramos Coin and Apple and Google being involved in it. And also another incident in which Aaron Barr was flown to Booz Allen headquarters to talk about Anonymous and WikiLeaks with one of the vice presidents there, William Wensley, something I had written about and documented in The Guardian years before. And, you know, these issues being the issues I had gone to prison over, something I was become an expert on. Roger Hodge, the editor I worked directly with, at that point, you know, for much of my prison stay, I didn't have email access. Portions I didn't have phone because I was throwing the shoe, disciplined for engaging in demonstrations and that kind of thing. But I was, you know, dealing with them on the prison, federal prison email sort of substitute thing where we can access. And he was telling me that him and Betsy Reed, the other editor there, the other major editor, has been there for a while. They think that I'm incorrect here and that these guys were just hustling for business, bragging about Apple and Google. You know, they were just trying to impress people. And I explained to him, no, Roger, these are actually, first of all, these are all documented in these emails. And second of all, they're not talking to clients about this. They're talking to Apple and Google. And they're setting up meetings with Apple and Google. I can tell you where they were at. Let me have Kevin Gallagher, the guy who runs my pre-Red Brown deal, let me have him send you those emails so you can look at them. And what I discovered in this exchange was that apparently I wasn't an expert on this. It turns out that editors, not having seen the source material and not having ever written about these issues before, declare for themselves a sort of expertise over all things. And so even when the emails were provided to him showing that and the Booz Allen incident, which he also objected to, even when he got those emails, he still continued to argue his original position. At some point, they finally folded and agreed that, okay, maybe this is the case, and said I could do it in the next column. But that was it was very disenchanting to be at the tail end of one's prison term. And you've seen all these articles in The Nation, and Glenn Greenwald himself, their boss or their co-founder, you know, saying, look, Barry Brown was right about these things. Here's what he found, and blah, blah. And knowing that, I guarantee you this guy either heard from John Cook, and John Cook said, oh, yeah, Barry Brown's a fraud, you know, Adrian Chin, and I told so, you know, because he made up a kidnapping in Mexico, and, you know, Chin reported on that. And of course, I've got Chin on recording from 2012 admitting he doesn't believe that. And he's probably seeing the Rolling Stone article that falsely claimed that I'd gone through the Strap for emails and thought that Trapwire was the most important thing and misrepresents my position on it and has me discovering things I never discovered and has me discovering things that, and has me not discovering things I did and has me saying, you know, really extraordinary article that basically the end thrust of it is that I'm kind of a kooky, unreliable guy who tried to get involved in this, but he's an amateur. Quoted Tim Shorrock, who was one of the people who actually went up, documented Booz Allen Hamilton years ago, one of the early people doing this stuff, and appears to have given him a inaccurate representation of what my opinion was on Strapper, because they've got him saying, oh, what kind of applaud anyone you know, going into these issues, but you know, some of these Strapper things, you know, what kind of intelligence agency would buy this intelligence? And no one ever proposed, in my understanding, that Stratfor sold intelligence to intelligence agencies. That was not at all what's written very publicly back then by me. Stuff like that. And since then, I've learned from Tim Shorrock that his quote was not properly using context. And that was did that publicly when I was reading the Rolling Stone article. Anyway, but nonetheless, those articles were out there. And so there's this impression that some people still have and that there's not much I can do about it, because you can't start a conversation with, hi, I'm Barrett Brown. By the way, I'm not a fraud, and I was right about these things. You can't start a conversation like that, and you never know who you're going to deal with, who, in the course of trying to present these issues, who's going to think otherwise. And I guess Roger Hodge was one of them, Betsy Reid, because they just, for some reason, did not think I could be relied upon to provide an account of something I've already written about for The Guardian, for one thing. So that's the beginning of the critique, and then it extends onward from there. Glenn Greenwald, Glenn Greenwald back in 2011, 2012, he's one of the people that I'd say actually he's the person that I warned most and most specifically about the very capabilities and firms that would later play this major role in undermining the 2016 election. Remember, Glenn Greenwald was one of the ones targeted by Palantir. And then Glenn Greenwald, among other things, you know, he knows very well these firms are dangerous and disreputable. But he lost interest in them after it was no longer about him. And I think the last exchange I had with him by email in 2012 was a month after I was raided by the FBI over HB Gary and Endgame Systems, two of the firms that were involved in targeting him, that were now targeting me, along with the FBI. And I didn't say, hey, give me some help here. I'm going to go to prison. I'm scared. I said, here's an article I just wrote for The Guardian about some of these issues and also about another journalist like you who was targeted by Leone Industries, another one of these firms. It's a big problem. It's not going away. Please focus on persona management, which is the capability that's used by this company, Side Group now, under a different term. Please focus on persona management and bring it to wider attention, because I'm going to have trouble haranguing people about this from prison. All I asked him was to take this research that emerged from the conspiracy against him and write about it at some point, while I was in prison for intervening to defend him. That's all I asked him. And he didn't do that. He didn't even write about the Leone Industries thing, about the other journalist at USA Today was being targeted. When he said, oh yeah, I'm gonna write about this next week, I went back, he didn't write that. He is, you know, and that stuff I was willing to keep my mouth shut about for years and years. It's just, there was no point in bringing it up until I started to learn more about what these companies ended up doing in the election when that started to come out. I knew they were dangerous. I wrote very specifically in my Romus Coin articles and blah, 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 that these things, these firms and these capabilities like persona management are going to be used against the American people in a significant way. It is inevitable. And then I come out and Adrian Chen is writing about these things for New York Times. And so I guess I've sort of just gradually snapped in the last couple of years, maybe in the last few months, over this. It's just, it's so egregious, and it's, and The Intercept is very much at the center of it. You know, The Intercept, of course, their first editor was John Cook, who, as I explained, you know, still knows quite a bit of things that it's too late to help me. But Chelsea Manning is sitting there, and I don't care about the well-being of Assange, but those rights need to be protected because they're all of our rights, and they're definitely the rights of journalists. And they know exactly – they know this information, that were it to be made publicly known – to an extent that I just can't do right now, it would change the conversation, and it would make clear what has actually been happening with the DOJ and press rights, and it might help to get Chelsea Manning out of prison, and it might help give her some hope. I can tell you, as someone who the first 6 months I was in prison, you know, it didn't look like, you know, that I was going to be getting out, and didn't look like the things that we had all done, all other people in prison for as well, we're going to make a difference. Until, you know, these articles started appearing, and, you know, we were able to kind of get people to pay attention to these things, and the fact that my search warrant that Michael Hastings put up on BuzzFeed about a month after my first FBI raid listed Project PM, HP Gary, in-game systems, and all these other things. There was clearly an attack on my research. That's what it was. And that started to become evident, you know, gradually, but, you know, it's – so The Intercept – having employed him, having employed Sam Biddle, who wrote a sympathetic portrait of this FBI informant named Jennifer Emick, who was also working for HP Gary, to get me arrested, to get me imprisoned. Something that came out when her emails were hacked and leaked, you know, well, years and years ago, and ran this whole sympathetic portrait, which Anonymous is being portrayed as this horrible terrorist group, which is what she used to call it. So he's basically accidentally part of an HP Gary operation against journalists and against me and against my mother, who of course was going to be indicted as well, to put pressure on me. And brought this to his attention a month ago when I remembered that article and looked up and saw it was him and it was at The Intercept now. I was like, oh my God, why? You know, and he won't address it. He won't respond. These people are, you know, and it just goes beyond that. As John Kiriakou has pointed out, you know, in the statement that we put out at the Intercept's little video cast we did where I burned the National Magazine Award, you know, he's pointing out Matthew Cole has been responsible either by negligence or whatever, you know, so that should have been something that they Intercept explains and says, hey, this is what went wrong here. But at some point, I don't know, at some point there doesn't, you're aware that there have been articles by, again, Tim Sharrock, incidentally, and yes. Ken Silverstein, formerly at Harper, about, you know, the other theories here. And I don't have a strong opinion on any of those theories about what the motivation might be and who might know. I've talked to people, you know, who are very, you know, like Laura Poitras, for instance, who was there at the foundation. They don't think necessarily that that's what it is, or there's anything like that, that it's anything kind of involving intelligence, involving a kind of subterfuge.
Well, I believe Silverstein believes it's it's literally an intelligence operation.
Yeah. So, yeah, Silverstein believes, and Sharrock is kind of pointing the same direction. I think, well, he's basically asserted it, I think, pretty openly by now that, yeah, they believe that it was by a paramilitary, that it was intended to be an intercept. There's a cute name to intercept leaks and to identify the leakers and otherwise monitor things. I have trouble. You know, if that were the case, I would certainly have a hard time believing that maybe Jeremy Scahill, for instance, would have been involved in that. There are people like John Cook who are clearly compromised by the FBI. I mean, it could have been. I don't mean he's working with the FBI. I'm saying that had the FBI, you know, along with Adrian Chen, had they wanted to, given what the FBI intercepted of theirs, like they're reporting on Anonymous, they could have easily said, hey, you need to. There's a few things we need you to do for us, and we're not going to indict you if you do them. And those are the exact kind of people who would do that. It's that kind of thing. It's one of the things where I kind of hope it's an intelligence operation, The Intercept, because the other alternative is that this is the best they can do, and that this is, you know, it's worse for journalism if this is literally them trying, or literally this is supposed to be the outlet that's going to help whistleblowers. It's going to focus on important issues. And you have Glenn Greenwald, when they closed down the Snowden archive, putting out a statement saying, oh, well, you know, these other newspapers still have the Snowden, a lot of the Snowden emails. Of course, none of them had the entire set. And they're not really reporting on them anymore. So, and also budget constraints. And meanwhile, he's making $500,000 a year.
Well, aren't they hiring new reporters too, or new investigators, despite saying that they ran out of money?
Well, they fired the research team, and they did put out an ad that was brought to my attention by actually a current staffer there. It's one of a number of people who were there and very unhappy. You know, that yes, they were hiring a new researcher, but that apparently was to replace someone who had left previous to that. So it's kind of a gray area. But the fact of the matter is that research team constituted a very small portion of their budget. And it's a research team. And it's really hard. I think it's hard to justify the other things they're spending their money on and then firing the research team. The most noble explanation in terms of their deals is so ignoble that it might as well not be an explanation. And, you know, I got to be careful about getting into how sure I am of certain things, because it involves, you know, some of the people who are kind of talking behind the scenes. But, you know, there was some reason they wanted that research team fired. And either it's because they wanted the Snowden archive closed for some reason that is – perhaps embarrassing, or there was some reason they wanted the research team out that is either embarrassing or something else. I don't know. But just nothing, none of it is good. I mean, it should be very clear from the way they handled this and the way they refused to answer questions, and from them blocking Laura Poitras from meeting over the future of these emails, which, as I remind people, she got them before Glenn did, because Glenn, you know, brushed off Snowden, and Snowden went to Laura Poitras, and she understood the significance first, and she wasn't allowed in the meeting. I mean, that's extraordinary. That's an extraordinary thing for an outlet that bills itself as having just concluded 5 years of fearless adversarial journalism. And then meanwhile, every single one person there is a coward who wouldn't answer my questions when put nicely to them about a month ago. We had this one editor there, tech editor. I guess I just found out a couple days ago, he sort of subtweeted me, which is to say he had referred to my arguments, but without mentioning my name or anything, and done so for those who were aware of them, and mocked them. And I found that last night, and I said a few things to him about it. That's the only acknowledgement that's come from anyone at The Intercept, except for the ones who are leaking stuff to me, that I've made any kind of criticism at all. And it didn't go very well. And that says something. You know, it says something terrible about The Intercept, is something similarly bad about journalism.
Well, you know, I always tell my listeners that I like to end on a positive note. That's kind of hard to do when we're talking about all these issues. You mentioned Michael Hastings. You know, we've lost a lot of good journalists. Do you think there's any, any glimmer of hope in any of this? Maybe with the Pursuance Project?
I've got a plan in place that I've been thinking about, and I've just kind of, I think, have kind of solved in the last few weeks, by which this can be fixed gradually. That involves sort of a carrot and stick initiative that we'll be conducting, as well as something called the Process Congress that I'll be explaining more about, announcing the participants soon, probably next week at the Tennessee Library Association when I speak there. What we're going to do is provide for free to any journalist who wants to try them out and use them forever if they want, volunteer staffed, curated crowdsourced research networks, more refined and much more advanced than the kind of things we used back in Project PM to figure out all of these and all these subjects regarding the intelligence contracting and propaganda and data mining capabilities. The things we used, the things that were effective enough the FBI wanted to come after it and shut it down. We're going to provide these curated networks to do research and help fact check and provide ideas for visual stories in this way that will not burden the journalist or expose the journalist to a lot of people. It's all sort of filtered down into a couple of people that he deals with. The journalist would choose for his or herself. they'll be very effective, and they will absolutely ensure that their output is far superior and far better for the citizens that rely on this journalism. And those who want it will make it available to them. And there's a number of ways that can work, and there's different designs for it, and that's a lot of that's some of the things we'll be showing pretty soon. And those who aren't interested in that, those who aren't interested in using something new to improve their output for the public service they do, for the stuff they're paid to do, for the citizenry, those who think that they don't need these things will be also be using these crowdsourced research networks to audit their work, find their errors, and make them extraordinarily and permanently public, and compile all of this on a site, sort of like the site we have for Project PM, that could be used as a resource. And I think we'll probably have a very high return on Google, such that anyone who searches anyone's name, whether, you know, if they're applying for a job or going on a Tinder date, or if it's, you know, their children someday, one of the first things they'll find is an account of their failures. And I think over time, as this carrot and stick method is implemented more widely, I think we will we'll see more discussion about what needs to be done in the press and what kind of reforms are needed, and whether or not it makes sense to continue relying upon the writer-editor model that we've inherited from 17th century London, with that having been updated in any fundamental way. I think we'll have more conversation about that, and I think they'll stop ignoring it out of necessity.
I mean, do you think I know a lot of people think the future is grim. Do you think there's a possibility that we're heading in a better direction, not just with your work, but just with the people as a whole?
Well, the idea is in the air. It's been in the air for years of using emergent civics, of taking advantage of the facts, taking advantage of our new environment, taking advantage of the fact that any person can collaborate with another person all of a sudden. I mean, in historical terms, this is a very sudden change, and it's not yet been explored in the directions that it needs to be explored much, even by us. We've barely begun. I think it's inevitable, first of all, that this kind of emergence, these more procedural mechanisms that are non-institutional, will be used and implemented and experimented with. Unfortunately, the threat exists that these will be used by, say, you know, nationalists or ethno-nationalists, ethnic state supporters.
Nativists, alt-right, yeah.
Yeah, to organize themselves as a polity. And the problem with that is it's a very effective technique. It's very poorly understood among the public at large and among the press at large, and pretty much everyone except for small groups of people who have come out of this information and activism community, and myself and Party Pursuance and all that, as well as some of the intelligence agencies. They understand it. So 10 years from now, if the Chinese have decided to implement a system of process democracy, which is what I term these things, that is authoritarian and that uses like the state social credit system, puts it in place so that anybody who has an 8 in their loyalty to the Chinese regime can give orders to anyone who has a 6, for instance, and implements this on some massive scale, then you're going to see the Chinese have a massive advantage over everyone else. Even beyond whatever other advantages they have. The means of organization, the means of collaboration, the means of working effectively and efficiently, these are obvious. This is where a lot of the change will come from. This is where a lot of the conflict will come from. It's easy to envision why this is a weapon. It's easy to, you know, and so I hope to ensure that the people who support the open society in general and who have broad, shared values get to it first and best and fastest, and so they can grow fastest. Because these things properly organized, it's not that complicated either. These things properly organized, they can grow exponentially without being bogged down, and they can keep refining themselves. The Pursuant system can do that. The process Congress thing I'm implementing, which is not going to be using the software, the instance, the application that we're developing for the Pursuant system, but will still be a step towards that. That would grow, you know, fairly exponentially, starting with this large number of formidable leaders in different sectors, including politics and even intelligence and military. You're going to have this very complicated, very baroque, very hard to predict conflict. As these kinds of things come about and take on nation states and then as nation states begin to use them as well. And as different sectors, different religions, different ideologies likewise organize themselves into these, you know, self-organized civic platforms. And you're going to have a great deal of conflict, because it's become very clear to a lot of people, not just that things are screwed up, not that just that these are these institutions that overlap the world, that are largely criminalized and largely intractable, that they're actually not that intractable, that they actually have a lot of weak points. And so the general barrier to organizing opposition to injustice is the idea that, oh, well, the other people aren't going to do it, so without a whole lot of people, it's not going to work, or that, oh, there's no means to do it. As that, as it becomes clear that's no longer true, to the extent that it ever was true, and as it becomes clear that actually there's a way, without having to get everybody to march to the same drumbeat, you actually can create a federation of that sort. You can do it in your spare time from your bedroom, as we did with Anonymous, and as Assange did with WikiLeaks, that you can actually absolutely create something that will shake up the geopolitical landscape, perhaps for the better. But either way, that's the best option. It's the only option I see, and a lot of other people see, that I have worked with. The alternatives are relying on institutions to change, which is not something institutions are very good at doing.
Well, I feel like in a lot of ways we're at a crossroads in history, you know, between the democratic values and the authoritarian ones.
Yeah, and so process democracy, as I call it, which you know, we it's best explained in contrast to institutional democracy, you know, in which all participants have the equal ability to create these very agile, very scalable, very customizable entities, which we call pursuances in this case, that are kind of like living organizational charts, or if you think about a primordial soup, or you think about molecules, it would look like a lot of those, and can you connect in various ways, share information, or have a more formal connection. You start putting thousands and thousands of people into this, and we have a couple thousand who have signed up to participate in the last 2 years. And we also have a huge number of, an unusually large number of very prominent, capable people who've been in leaders in different sectors to start out with. You set that in motion, and you give it the right protocols, which are very simple, the right the rule. Suddenly, the problems that usually come up when you're trying to organize coalitions, problems of not wanting to give up independence, not being able to organize things, when self-organization like that comes into play in this kind of framework, it will be difficult to stop. There's no centralized leader, except to the extent people decide to follow one, which some people will, I suppose. But there is a cohesiveness in this that is not easy to affect when you have movements like Anonymous or Occupy Wall Street or the Arab Spring or anything else. It's something that it cannot fail. And even if it were to a pursuance, it's someone else is going to do it. It's important that, again, that we do it first and best. You know, that's the option before us, basically.
Okay. Well, I want to thank you again, Barrett Brown, for coming on Parallax Views. If there's anything you want to throw out there, just as a closing thought, or anything you want to plug.
Sure. If you would like to see the various portions of our little event the other day where I burned my National Magazine Award to coincide with the Intercept's cute little party in Brooklyn they had on April 16th, you can see that at my Twitter account there, which is Barrett Brown _. So I'm pinned to the top there. And you can see a whole list of articles I've either written or compiled that list the various sins of The Intercept and of journalism as practiced in America in general. And you can get a sense of how much worse it is than you probably expect. And pursuanceproject.org is where you can sign up to be notified when Pursuance is mobilized. And the Process Congress will be announced soon, and that will be something that will grow and that people will start receiving invitations to gradually over the next year. There you go. And if you're old school, we got the Pursuance, irc.pursuanceproject.org, which is just back up. We had some either attacks or technical difficulties that were down, but that's where we're going to be organizing some of the stuff in the meantime while we're putting in place these frameworks, but which should take things forward in the future. So if you're interested in imposing ethics on the press, which is how the way it has to be done apparently, come join us there and help us compile examples of errors or malfeasance to be collated and presented in a at a later time.
Well, hey, thank you again, Barrett Brown, for coming on Parallax Views.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with whistleblower, journalist, and gadfly, Barrett Brown. And, you know, if you want to tease out a little bit more of the Barrett Brown story, there's actually two documentaries about Barrett that are currently on YouTube. You can watch them for free, folks, entitled Accidental Warrior, The Life and Time of Barrett Brown. And then there's also Relatively Free, which chronicles the immediate aftermath of when Barrett was released from prison. Two very interesting documentaries. And, of course, there's also the Pursuance Project, which was founded by Barrett. You can find that at pursuanceproject.org. And, of course, there will be a link to that in the episode description. And I gotta say, the Pursuance Project has garnered the involvement of some impressive people, including Icelandic Member of Parliament Birgitta Jónsdóttir, CIA whistleblower John Kerouac, and even actor and filmmaker Alex Winter. Yes, that Alex Winter from the Bill and Ted comedy franchise. Lots of people don't realize this, but Alex Winter has actually been involved as a producer and director in some very fascinating documentaries about subjects related to transparency, including 2015's Deep Web and 2018's The Panama Papers. And actually, Alex also directed the aforementioned Barrett Brown documentary, Relatively Free, through the Journalism Film Unit, known as Field of Vision, which also released Alex's most recent short documentary, Trump's Lobby. Maybe of interest to my listeners, you can find that one on YouTube as well, actually. Many thanks to Barrett Brown for coming on. I'm sure his takes on, you know, everything from the Julian Assange arrest and the state of journalism to The Intercept will be, let's just say, polarizing. But hey, this is Parallax Views, and as we say, we're trying to give you perspectives that you may not have considered before. On that note, I have a backlog of shows that I am going to be releasing over the next few weeks. Got some Patreon content coming up, and lots more. Parallax Views is gaining steam. So get the word out there on social media if you're feeling generous. Donate to the Parallax Views Patreon. And just, you know, support the show. I love doing this for you guys, and I think we're going places with it. So thank you for listening. And with that being said, until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. If nothing else, if we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. new forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.